If you're like me, you might be looking at an old knick-knack or a piece of art that's been in your family forever and wonder, yeah, I wonder what that's worth. Maybe it's a treasure and I just don't know it. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. There are probably a lot more items in your attic whose value is sentimental, strictly. But once in a while, you might find a treasure hidden there as well. And if you're thinking of donating one of those items to charity, you'll want to know how to take a deduction on your taxes. And we have Shirley Bauman with us today. She's a certified personal property appraiser, a registered Wisconsin auctioneer. She's the owner of Bauman Auction Services and also her other business, Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. We have links up on our Facebook page, on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, to her businesses. And Shirley, great to see you again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, it'd be better if I turned on your microphone and not the one next to you.
Okay, it's great to be here.
Now I've got you.
Great. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure. We always have a lot of fun. I should give the number. You may have a question about this appraisal for tax deduction purposes, or maybe have something special you wonder what it might be worth, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. I see we have 6,998 people. I have two more to get 7,000 on my Facebook page.
Oh, I thought you meant on the line waiting to talk to me.
Well, that's coming. That's coming. I just as sure as taxes. Oh. The calls are coming. And, you know, tax day, less than a month away. What about getting an appraisal for the purpose of a charitable tax deduction? What do we need to have an appraisal? When do we need to have one done?
Well, there are special rules for art, antiques, and collectibles.
Okay.
When you have a donation of $500 or more, or you want to take a deduction of
right.
$500 or more, you are supposed to have an appraisal done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the appraisal doesn't need to be submitted to the IRS unless your deduction is $5,000 or more.
Okay.
However, if you were to be audited and you had, say, a $1,000 deduction and you didn't have anything to prove that, you could get into a problem without having anything to support that deduction. But you must submit it when it's $5,000 or more.
And does it have to be, could it come from Mueller's fly-by-night estimation services or what?
No, not quite. I'm sure you might know a lot about it, but that fly-by-night doesn't really work in this case. The appraiser has to have certain qualifications, and they're interesting. While there's no real laws about it, the Appraisal Foundation, which is authorized by Congress, says that an appraiser must be either have the experience, they want education from a recognized mm-hmm. organization and experience as an appraiser. You must hold yourself out as regularly as an appraiser who gets compensated okay. for that work. And the report must be submitted according to the standards of the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, also called USPAP.
Okay.
And the easiest way, or I think the best way, to make sure you're in compliance with the USPAP standards is to take a class that's offered by the Appraisal Foundation, a 15-hour class to begin with, and then every 2 years you take a 7-hour update class, so that you can follow those standards and rules.
Okay. And you've done that.
I've done that, and I keep taking my 2-year update. So, but that's really what's necessary to.
Well, on the other end of it, who needs to be the beneficiary for it to count as a tax deduction?
Well, you have to have a recognized, 503C organization.
Okay.
Or the equivalent of that. I think there are some with a few other initials and numbers, but a 503C recognized organization. A lot of the ones that I've done appraisals for might be museums, and museums mm-hmm. do not do valuations. They won't do your appraisal for you. But I just had, for example, did an appraisal of a drawing that was submitted by an alum who lived in Hawaii, actually, and donated an artwork to the Chazen down here, the museum mm-hmm. at the UW here. We do a lot for people who have book collections and might donate those to one of the libraries.
Sure.
I've done some for people who have a collection of religious art and had donated that to their place of worship. I've even done some for people who have demolished and rebuilt a home. And the donation there is the products in the house, the cabinetry, the windows, the doors that go to Habitat for Humanity. Light fixtures, fans, all those kinds of things that they can deconstruct the home rather than just raise it and recycle those materials.
Well, that's great. I was thinking I've done a little of that, but my donations have never been, you know, I haven't had a $5,000 fan, right, for example. But
now, there is one other thing to realize, that if your donation is very large, and that's $20,000 or over in the IRS department, actually, in their eyes, it's a $20,000 deduction or more, then the appraisal and your request will go to committee in the art and antiques world. And the committee will look it over very closely to see if that's accurate. Some other ones are randomly chosen to go to committee, but over 20,000, they always will. And they have experts on that committee, and it's some of those people that you see on the Antiques Roadshow are in the Art and Antiques committees. And they take time, and they look through the appraisals, and they look through the appraiser's analysis. And, you know, if they come to the conclusion, they say, oh, yes, I've sold a painting by that artist very often for $50,000. That's appropriate. Or they might say, you know, that doesn't sound right, because that artist usually doesn't bring that much. So let's look at their analysis and see why that appraiser thinks this one in particular is more than the standard. And sometimes there might be a reason for it. You know, in a antique, maybe it's a very unusual, rare size for a piece. So it would be worth more than the standard that they make. It all depends. And sometimes it's a collection of things. Individually wouldn't make that, but collectively, yeah, it makes that number. And sometimes the IRS comes back to an appraiser. I've participated in this before and say, we have a deduction that someone has taken that's, we feel, is too high. So research this for us. So you go, and it was a reason it was here, and was that they came to somebody in Wisconsin. And so then you research it kind of for the IRS to say, is this right or is this not? So it's a pretty interesting part of my business.
It sounds like it. And you said for 20,000, they're always going to.
Over 20,000, they're always going to look at it.
And then is it, but what about under? I mean, most of us are going to be probably way under,
right?
Perhaps.
It's probably the same chances that you get as in terms of a standard audit.
Okay.
As far as what they're going to look for. But, you know, it will be reviewed, as every deduction is. And, you know, it's going to be reviewed for to be over or under. And especially when you have estates, you know, this isn't tax purposes, but it's estate tax. I mean, it's not the deduction, but the estate tax will be looked at in the same way. Is this too high or too low? They want to make sure the appraiser knows both ends of the situation. And the thing, when you're doing a non-cash charitable contribution deduction, you need to submit Form 8283. When you have that amount, and it's one page back and front, and on that page, and you have to say what the item is, what condition it was in, who donated it, when, to whom. You need to get that all authorized. And there's also a section for the appraiser's declaration of value. So the appraiser signs that this is what I believe this is worth as well. So when you have those large deductions, you need to have that form.
Shirley Bauman, our guest, certified personal property appraiser and a registered Wisconsin auctioneer. She owns Bauman Auction Services and Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. Great to have her along. You may have some questions for her, and if you do, I hope you'll join in. Maybe it's a tax question, or maybe you just have an item you want to have some idea about its value. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, Nick in Green Bay has been waiting a while, so let's go to Nick. Nick, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I got a Packer hat. I got it when I was, 19. I got a few signatures. Well, now we got probably 30, 40 signatures, and the latest one is Aaron Rodgers. Took it to a card shop to ask him just for insurance reasons how much it's worth. He's like, not worth anything. It's not even valuable. And I think he's just saying that to see if I'd sell it to him. But I just, like I said, I want to get some insurance on it, but I got no clue how much it's worth. Like I said, there's no room anymore on the hat for signatures.
Hmm. And it's full of, it's all Packers.
It's all Packers. All like Don Beebe, Reggie White. I mean, like I said, the last one I got was Aaron Rodgers, so that's got to be worth a little bit because, you know, Aaron is our man, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do you think, Shirley?
Well, that's a really good question, and we have lots of interest in sports collectibles, so I appreciate your question. Insurance is a good reason to get ask the question, what's it worth? Do you have any of the Packers from the 60s on it, Hall of Famers from the 60s?
I do not. It's just mostly the recent guys.
Okay, and you've got a Hall of Famers in there as well, so mm-hmm. that's good. And they, it is worth something, and I think you brought up a good point that maybe the dealer was just trying to undervalue it to get a deal from you. When we see autographed items go at auction, like for situations where people are trying to raise money for a charitable cause, we see them often go in the range of $75 maybe for a signature and a little bit per signature and less for a lesser known player. I think Aaron Rodgers' signature right now is probably going to be higher than that because he's been, you know, so doing so well in the team for the team.
Reggie White would probably be.
Reggie White as a Hall of Famer and who's passed on now.
Yeah.
And as we sometimes say in the business, deader is better because mm-hmm. then you can't, nobody else can get that signature.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's good, and I suppose you have some of the other stars on the team. I can't tell you how much, but if you look at, maybe kind of average it out in that range of, you know, $75 for a well-known player, a little bit more for some of the big stars, and a little less for the others, you can kind of count it up, but your insurance company may or may not take that. They may require a written evaluation mm-hmm. For you on it in terms of what to put on for a value. I'd say take photographs of it so that if you have a loss, it goes, you know, there's a tornado and it's gone or something like that. Mm-hmm. Certainly do that. And if you get more signatures in the future, have someone snap a picture of you while you're getting the signature because that authenticates it and proves that it's a original signature.
Yeah, that's a good point. And probably ought to type up a little story anyway.
Yes.
If for nothing else, for the heirs.
Yep. Just put it inside the cap in the sweatband or something so that little note stays with it.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks a lot for calling. We have other questions here. Stu and Madison, let's give you a chance next. Hi, Stu. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a National gold pocket watch, and it was made between 1867 and 1876, and I would like to get it appraised, but I've gone online, and the only thing I can find is people off in distant places that want me to ship it to them, and I'm not inclined to do that because I don't know how valuable it is. I don't have it insured. Do you know of any place local where they would have information about this?
I do, and you have. It's a good question because finding appraisers that specialize in these things can be difficult. You want somebody who knows the watch works as well as can tell if it's 10 karat gold, 14 karat, 18 karat gold, or maybe it's gold filled or gold plated. So they need to look at that. There is a jewelry appraiser that I work with often that I refer people to, and her name in Madison is Lisa Bodie. That's B-O-D-I. And I think you can look her up, and if not, give me a call or contact me through my website, and I can give you her number. And you could also go to a local jeweler because they can check the gold content, and you know, if they sell watches, they can certainly look at the watch works. However, they might not also know, in addition, what the antique value is.
Yeah.
So those are a couple of options for you.
Good, good points. Thanks a lot for calling, Sue. Appreciate it. Shirley Bauman, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking antiques and appraisals today, and zeroing in a little bit on appraisals for charitable deductions. Talked a lot about that with our guest, Shirley Bauman, who owns Bauman Auction Services and Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. So it's great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in and for your questions. Anita's got a neat question, I think, from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I always thought that if something was 100 years or older, then it was an antique. But I looked it up in my trusty unabridged, and it said 25 years or more. So I have two questions. One is, when does something become technically an antique? And then if I had a document or a teapot or anything that, you know, was 25, 60 years old, and it was a certain value, then when it became over 100 years old, does the value shoot way up? Does that make it like something officially antique, and so it becomes greater value?
Those are good questions.
They sure are. And interestingly enough, this is just a discussion we had at a conference I attended recently on estate sales. And one of our speakers said he felt an antique was 63 years old or older. And why he came up with 63, I think it was like 50 years or more. You see what he's saying that? And but the IRS, for their purposes, does say 100 years. Now, that, again, there's not a law about this, but that's the number that they've come up with. So that's generally what I go with, and a lot of the people do. Another one of the persons we were talking with at the conference said anything pre-Industrial Revolution was her opinion. And she said, because once it's mass-produced, how can it be an antique? Well, antique is more about the age, in my opinion, than the production value. So it's really a hard thing, but I would not say 25 years. I think that's too new. That's a vintage piece, and there are, you know, certain values that the piece is, and it's collectible. Now, the other thing is, just because something's old doesn't mean it's valuable.
Yeah.
So that if it hits that mark, I'm sorry, that doesn't just automatically shoot it into a valuable category. I think it becomes more interesting the older it gets, but it's not necessarily more valuable.
And, you know, watching Antiques Roadshow, you'll often, somebody will say, well, you know, 5 years ago, this was really selling well, and now interest has waned, and this item is not selling as well, and even though it's 5 years older.
Right, and I hear that from customers a lot. Well, 20 years ago, someone told me it was worth a lot more than you're saying it's worth. Well, the antiques and art is a market.
Yeah.
It goes up and down according to people's interests, sometimes the media develops an interest in something and it'll shoot up. I used to say, if you watch the Martha Stewart show, what she put on was suddenly going to be valuable. And I think now it's, you know, the American Pickers and the Roadshow and those kinds of things that help that. But it goes up and down. Otherwise, we just buy things and hold on to it and get rich. And it just doesn't work that way.
Anita, great questions. Thank you so much. Alan in Grant County, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you, Larry. I'd like to ask your guest about donating original pen and ink drawings to a nonprofit corporation, drawings that I have done myself, and wondering, because I never did it commercially or sold many, can I value those just at the number of hours I've got in them? For instance, if it takes me 20 hours to do a drawing and I value it at $10 an hour, can I value that at $200 as a donation to a nonprofit to sell to raise funds?
Well, I'm sorry, you cannot do it that way. Since you don't have established value, if you had established that every one of your works or the average sales price for your work was $200, then you could substantiate that and do it. If you don't have a sales record, then you have to value it according to the material cost. So your paper, your ink, your that kind of thing, your supplies. That's the deduction you can take.
What about, just as a, to add to this, mm-hmm. what, let's say Alan donates his drawings, and each drawing is then sold for $100. Can he then say, okay, well, it was sold for $100, so therefore the value is the value $100 for a deduction for me?
Well, that's not the way it works. We wish it did, because the IRS or whoever will say, weren't people just bidding up so that they could make a nice donation? They liked the work, but maybe they were just bidding higher than cost to be able to donate to that cause.
Okay.
So that's why without a – now, if you'd done this year after year for to a commercial client, and that's what they want for $100 each, then you could start to do that because you have a record.
All right. Got it. And Judy in Lodi, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Larry and Shirley. You have to forgive me, I've got bronchitis, so I get a tickle and I'll start coughing.
Oh.
I have a table that's been in my family for 5 generations. I don't know what they mean by generations anymore, but it was my great-great-grandmother's. It had the original, I have a tab underneath who the was made by Johnson & Johnson in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My daughter, I don't have a computer or any way of checking things out. I contacted the Antique Roadshow. They never got back to me. I tried getting a hold of the Kino Brothers because they're more into furniture. And nobody's ever returned anything, my mail or anything. It's beautiful. It's got all inlaid wood on top. It's an octagon table. It stands about 3 feet up. It's got the legs that are, it's just all hand-done work. It's just, I babied this thing more than I did my kids.
Yeah.
And I can never get anybody to give me a breakdown on what it might be worth. It's going to be handed down to my oldest granddaughter. My son and her are fighting over it right now because I'm 73 years old And right now, I've got nothing sitting on it but my doilies that actually my great-great-grandmother made by hand, and she was totally blind. This table, if you saw it, Shirley, I'm not kidding, you'd want it to take home.
I probably would want to take it home. It sounds beautiful.
It's heavy. It's very, very heavy.
Sure.
It took 4 people to bring it in. It's quite larger than you wouldn't call it a side table or anything, or a card table. It's like I said, because it's octagon.
Mm-hmm.
But the inlaid wood, I mean, it's every kind of wood that I believe that from every tree that we have in the United States.
Oh, very nice.
Wow.
Very nice. Well, to go back to the beginning, I think a generation is somewhere around 20, 25 years, because that's when, a period when, you might think there'd be another addition to a family when someone's in that age range in the 20, 30-year period. So you can kind of figure out that 20, 30 years maybe is about a generation.
So you're about 100.
100, 125
years
old.
Mm-hmm.
And Grand Rapids was a center for a lot of furniture building during that period. So we'd have to do research to find out exactly the maker in that. But there are many furniture makers in Grand Rapids. They had a lot of nice wood there, and they also had a lot of oak wood there. And that's why we see a lot of oak furniture up here in the Midwest. And maybe the primary wood in your table is oak and then inlaid with all these other woods. So that wouldn't surprise me a bit, and that would be the right period for Grand Rapids furniture.
Well, this was done by Johnson & Johnson, they're no longer in business.
Yeah. So there were many furniture manufacturers at that time. And, at that time it wasn't the big factories that we have now. It would be a small cabinet shop or a small woodworking shop. So that's probably what you're dealing with. It's not surprising to find that Grand Rapids label. And, of course, you know, somebody in the Midwest probably moved from Michigan to Wisconsin, brought their beautiful table with them. As far as value, I really can't tell you exactly what it is without seeing the table.
Yeah,
because, you're describing it as a very nice table. So the inlays make a difference. It's the quality of the workmanship, again, condition, and those kinds of things. So, you know, I guess that's what I have to tell you about it right here on the air. Larry, you look like you got a question.
Well, I'm trying to think now. There's Judy in Lodi. She needs, if she got some good photos or if she could, sounds like it's too heavy to haul to someplace.
Right.
But maybe if she had some good photographs to take to an appraiser, and what kind of appraiser would she go to?
Well, you'd want to go to someone who has experience in furniture. However, if you're doing this for insurance purposes, which it sounds like you want to keep it in the family, so that's a possibility, the appraiser really probably would not appraise it from photographs. We can't really tell condition. We can't tell construction. You know, when I go into a home and look at a table, I'm underneath the table looking at the bottom side and all the details. So we can't see that really well. If you just want an idea, a photograph would help. But I think you might want to call in an antique furniture appraiser or an antique generalist appraiser that includes furniture, credentialed appraiser, and write you up a little report for that so that you could keep it in your family, have it properly insured, and then pass that on with the table so that your heirs in the future can get their appraisal updated to have appropriate insurance on it.
Yep, absolutely. Good luck with that. There may be somebody in Lodi area.
I don't know right off anybody
right off
who has, but some auctioneers have taken appraisal courses. So that's a possibility if there's an auctioneer who's got what they call the GPPA, Graduate Personal Property Appraiser designation. You might check with them.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Judy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Sam and DePere. How often should a collectible be reappraised? I have a collectible that my father had appraised more than 10 years ago.
Well, generally speaking, we usually talk about 5 to 7 years. And depending on what the collectible is, if you're seeing on, you know, media and whatever, that's a really hot thing, you might want to get it done on the shorter end of that. For example, advertising, the nice porcelain advertising signs have gone really up in the last few years. So I'd say every 5 years minimum on something like that. But 5 to 7 years is a good rule of thumb.
Facebook question from Sandy. What was the, you may not have seen this, Antique Roadshow had a blanket that was worth $250,000.
Yes.
She says, I have a red, white, black stripe wool that looks like that one.
Ah.
Also, I have bowls. One is a carnival glass, the red, white, and blue hue, and a yellow one, forgot what it's called, both about 6 inches high and across. So, what are the chances?
Well, that blanket was really special, and I did see that one, and I actually saw it in person when I was in Santa Fe. The person who has it was invited to our appraisers conference, and we were there, the dealer who was dealing with it. And that was a Indian Chief's blanket, Navajo, and I believe it was called First Stage, which is the earlier period. And it's got to be a Navajo made in the early period for yours to be the same. Now, if you can probably go back on the internet and find that exact appraiser on the Antiques Roadshow website, because they keep archives of that, and look really, really closely for details. Just because it's similar, it could doesn't mean it's the same. It could be modern Navajo made. Mm-hmm. It could be and to make sure it's, if someone would think it really could be that, they would do a scientific test on the fibers to find out if it really truly is that old and being, you know, if it were that valuable or a question that they think it may be. But it has to be exact. Size would be the same. The dye color is important, and that would come up in the, you know, the dye, of the both the color and the chemistry of the dye that was used. Back then it was natural dyes. Later we get into chemical dyes. So, you know, that's what you'd have to do. And a lot of people tell me they have things that look like, oh, this was on the Antiques Roadshow, and unfortunately I've not come up with one that was actually the same thing. Similar just doesn't make it in the world of antiques and art. But, you know, look into the item's history. Was it from the Southwest? How did you get it? What's its history? Where did it come from?
Yeah.
You know, that will kind of help you eliminate some of the possibilities, I guess. And the Bowles Carnival Glass is, it's a iridescent coating on the glass, and they were actually given away at carnivals decades and decades ago. They are not quite as popular as they've been, so the value of them has gone down. A 6-inch bowl, again, it depends on the pattern that's used. There's some that are very rare compared to others that we see very often. And the actual color, saying it's red, white, and blue in carnival glass, you know, that's probably the iridescence coming out. And what we have to look at is, which is the predominant color? Is it really a cobalt blue? Red, true red in the carnival glass arena is kind of rare, or at least unusual. Yellow, the marigold colors, are the most common. And then we see other colors too, greens and amethyst. So again, we've got to look at all those variations. And then look on the bottom. Is it signed? Maybe there's an N and a circle underneath it. That would mean it was made by Northwood's company. That made Northwood made a lot of carnival glass in the period. So who made it also makes a difference.
We have an email from Sam in De Pere. Oh, I'm sorry. We've dealt with that already. That had to do with getting something reappraised. Kelly, though, that's where I was meant to go, says, I have a client with an electric piano that can also be manually played. She's interested in getting an appraisal. Do you appraise musical instruments, or could you recommend someone? I am aware that it does need some work, but the body itself is in excellent condition. So Kelly must be probably from the Madison area.
Yeah, and musical instruments is a more difficult area in which to get appraisals because you do need to have someone who specializes in that or is connected with other specialists. I've had a situation where I had a Steinway concert grand in an appraisal I was doing, and I called in a Steinway technician to help out. In the other cases, almost every appraisal event I go to, or nearly all of them, someone comes in with a violin that's labeled Stradivarius. And we know they're pretty much all accounted for, but it was common in the day when they were made to put that label in as a sign of honor.
Oh.
To that special violin maker. So we see a lot of those. Now, as far as an electric piano, we can kind of go back and look at the history of electric pianos and find out its age as to when they were first making them. And I think you could do that through Google and find, you know, and find if you can see the company's name, do that. I could probably do an electric piano from that kind of research, an electric manual, if we know the company's name, which is almost always on a piano. When could it have been made? And then you look at sales records. Have they been sold? And sometimes you need tools like I have that the general person wouldn't have based on, you know, databases with auction records in them. That, you know, I do a yearly subscription to, and the average person wouldn't do that who didn't do this often. You could also look in, if you've got a major music store, they may know of people in the area who can give you an appraisal. So you may give them a call and see what they have to say.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Sure. Thank you. I have some dessert plates that were my great aunt, and she was born around 1890. I have no idea how long she had them. But there are about eight of them, and they're about 8 inches across, and the mark on the back says H&O France with an L in the middle.
Okay.
Okay.
And I want to sell them because I need a little bit of cash if they're worth anything.
Okay. Well, a lot of porcelains, fine china like that, porcelains come out of France. They had the clay that would make really beautiful white white backgrounds on white plates or white china. And then they were decorated, of course. Haviland is maybe a Haviland and Company is one of the well-known ones out of France, and that's could very likely be what yours is without seeing the mark. I can't tell you for sure. But Haviland, Limoges is very collectible. Not everything that's Limoges, that's a city in France. Not everything marked Limoges is Haviland, but you may have the Theodore Haviland Company made china. Now, there's a couple of things to tell you about these. If you'd look on a replacement value like you were going to insure them, they'd probably come out rather high. The problem is trying to find a fair market value in this period of time. It would probably be lower than you might believe. You might find out because people just aren't buying those things right now. They're not popular for the younger set. In terms of having them as dishes they use, they don't entertain that way. They're much more casual. And they like things that can go in the dishwasher and the microwave for actual use. So as far as their resale value, it's probably based on the aesthetic and a little bit on the name. You know, if they're absolutely gorgeous and someone just wants, you know, that, or they also had a family member that had those, and so it's nostalgic, then you may be able to sell them. But in terms of an 8-inch, you know, Haviland Limoges dinner plate or 8-inch luncheon plate maybe, on replacement cost, you might see those at, oh, $50 a plate. But you could never in this day and age get that as a resale value. Maybe you could get, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 or 25. I think 25 a plate is probably too much, but I think that's possible. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a double-edged sword with china, fine china these days.
There you go, Sarah.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much for calling. Sorry we didn't have a little better news for you, but that's kind of the way it goes.
Yeah.
Shirley Bauman, certified personal property appraiser, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at appraisals today with Shirley Bauman, owner of Bauman Auction Services and also Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. You may have a question. Maybe you want to know about an appraisal for a charitable deduction, or maybe just you've got something you want to know maybe what it's worth. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. We'll get to Bruce from Green Bay in just a minute, but Cam sent us a Facebook note along with a photograph. She said, attached are two photos of a lithograph signed by Picasso, and then she gives a number of six-digit, 309 out of 500, wondering if you could tell her about this kind of piece of art.
Well, it's a little bit difficult to tell you anything real substantial right now. What you have, the number 309, that means it was the 309th one made out of a 500 print run. Now, there may be a few more of those because there might have been some artist proofs, some printer's proofs, but right around 500. And Picasso is difficult in terms of knowing his work. Some were made during the artist's lifetime, and some were made post his life, authorized by the family, so not being like reproductions. But the original during his lifetime that he supervised are a different kind of value than the ones that came later. So there's some Picasso experts in the country who have gotten confused by some of these things and in trouble with them. So I certainly couldn't tell you that from a, you know, photograph over the internet what you have. A lithograph is an earlier printing process or a printing process that people use when they say a lithograph. So they printed 500 of this particular work. And then again, you want to look and see if the signature is real or if it was printed also. He might have signed it in the plate, and then in the printing plate. And then when it's printed, you'll see a dot pattern in the signature. That would indicate that it was not signed by his hand. And you would do that under heavy magnification to see if that signature is right or not. So I can't really give a lot of specifics, but those are some things you might want to look for.
Now we'll go to Bruce in Green Bay. Bruce, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for getting my call. I've got a painting here that I got from my uncle. He worked for a guy that owned the Wrigley Ranch up in northern Wisconsin. And she made this painting of the ranch, and I've had it for 30-some years, and I have no idea if she's famous or not. Her name is Edna, I'll spell her last name, V-O-G-N-I-L-D. I don't know if that's anybody or not.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know right off the top of my head if it is either. But what I would do to research the name is start with a Google and put her name in and put it in quotation marks, just as you spelled it, and then put artist or painter, whatever you think would represent her best, and okay. Start Googling and see if you can see that. The major databases.
It's a heavy frame. You know, it's in a 25 by 20 frame. And it's heavy, and you know, I don't know. You know, it's glass and clothes and everything.
But you have that name. Start looking for that name, and actually, I can take a quick look to see if I can find something like that during our news break too. But that's where I would research it.
Yeah.
And those major databases, her name will come up, even if you can't get onto the databases. It will still show you that there's an entry for this person. So that's really how you find out if there's a... Larry's looking here.
Yeah, I just looked on my face, on my phone, my iPhone, and yeah, she pops right up. I just put in Edna Vogneld, artist, and got quite a...
quite a few.
Quite a few here. Lots of them. Exhibitions, prices, auction records.
That's great. Well...
and that was on a Google search.
That was just a real quick few seconds.
I would think this was done in the 50s. It'd be my guess from the top of Thunder Mountain looking back on that Wrigley Ranch, because I've been up there and seen this scene from up there.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, we've already determined she's a known artist in these in the little quick search that Larry did here. The thing you could do from here is do that yourself and look at some of these. Some of the... databases that have this artist listed will give you like a one-day subscription if you want it for maybe $10, something like that. So if you wanted to invest that much just to see what they say are the auction records, but make sure that they actually have records for her and not just a biography before you spend the money. But you can look at those databases to see what information they have about her before you pay for
It was kind of a personal thing because it says on the back to Mr. Edward Buck, who I think was on the ranch. And I think that it was just a personal thing to him, you know.
Well, you know, sometimes when there's a personal, you know, a connection, that can even make the work of art a little bit more valuable because, you know, the provenance and you know who it was for and when. So it's possible that might even push it up a little bit
in
value.
I'll check it out some more.
Yeah,
great.
there's a spot that says, one area that says past auction results for her paintings. So
good, that's where you want to go and see those past auction results. And then you kind of look at one that's a similar size, similar style, if another ranch or similar landscape.
Wow.
And size and close to the date, close to today as possible, because you want to know what they're going for today, not what they went for 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So
right.
That's how you then kind of average the cost value. Well,
looks like you might have something there, though.
Yeah, it does. It does.
All right.
Thanks, Bruce, for calling. Let us know if you find out you got a really valuable piece there. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, our own Antiques Roadshow moment.
Thomas in Arborvitae. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, you know, Not that I'm the genius. I'm listening to one here. But the thing is, I do fool around with glass, and I have that 200-year history of American glass, that big book.
Yeah.
And I have a compote here that when you get to page 82 in this book, it's made by John Bakewell in 1829 to 1830. And it's an ornamentation with increasing frequency. It was painted, possibly staining, inexpensive simulation flashing. I got the piece laying right here. It's got a three-mold, a three-seam base, which is fastened to the bottom of a bowl on a stem, and it's exactly what it is in the book. If it's a John Bakewell, I really am afraid to even think that it might be, because if it is, what am I doing with something from 1829, you know? I found it looking around, but as far as my family's concerned, I won't go that deep, even though my family originated from the East Coast during the American Revolution, and we settled Sheboygan County, the first 60 families, in 1829, before there was anything there. So I do have some glass items that belong to my great-great-great-grandmothers, but this particular one I come across one time, and when it's so beautiful and it's stained with red, like with a border of glass on the outside edge, which is enameled, and it's so doggone beautiful, you know. But can you imagine? Could it really be a Bakewell from 29?
Well, nothing's impossible. They do exist. And you mentioned a couple of things. You talked about the three-part mold that was used. That's why you have seam lines there.
Oh, no, that's the stem, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And those molds were wooden at the time. And not all of them were three-part. Some that were more complex would have been more parts. I was able to study at a museum for a week-long class on glass and ceramics. And we saw some of those molds in real life, and they could be very complicated, but they were usually three or more. Rarely, sometimes they had some similar simple pieces that were two, but so many of them had more. The red, first you talked about being a red flash on there.
There's tinting on, there's 20-some from swirls in it.
Okay.
With miniature small little half a BB size going all the way down both sides, and inside of that, the top is definitely pressed.
Okay, yes, and that would be because it was
pressed.
In a mold, it was pressed.
Yeah.
If you see mold lines on a piece of glass, it wouldn't be hand blown. It could have been blown into the mold, but it wouldn't be pressed.
When you look through it from the top, where the pedestal is put on, the outside the pedestal for 3/4 inch, it's clear. And you can see the distortions in it and the twist marks from it being turned when the bowl was being made.
Yeah. Those are all some telltale signs. You know, if the glass, you look at it, and it's got little seeds, they call it, or little bubbles in it. They didn't know how to make the glass quite as clear as we do now. Or little rippling in it, maybe. And like you talked about, the twists. That all makes a difference. And if you've got a book that shows you exactly and it gives you the exact size, and I'm talking about not 1/4 inch off, then you might want to have somebody take a look at it.
And you'd get Tom's in Arborvita, so you'd try and get somebody from the area?
Perhaps? Yeah, Arborvita is northeast.
It's pretty much north of Madison. Northeast, yeah. I'm sorry?
In some cases, when you go to these dealers and you get into this kind of a depth, it's a little above them. They're not used to it.
You're right. And that's why we look for appraisers that are accredited by the appraisal organization. I don't mean to say this as a generalization, but some dealers do not know all the details, and some dealers, you need to be careful that they're not just trying to buy it from you because they do think it might be something special. So a dealer might not be the place to go, but an accredited appraiser. And I know it's probably hard to find in your area, but if you're headed, I don't know, maybe towards a bigger city up there, you might be able to find something. And you can call museums to see if they have appraisers that they recommend.
Yeah. And
what about sending pictures of it to Christie's?
You could do that. If you can go on their website, they have a way of submitting photographs. So that is very much a thing to do. Now, you'll have to wait for a response. It isn't going to be fast. Someone who sent some things recently said, oh, just when I'd given up and thought they'd never get back to me, I heard from them. So you've got to wait and be patient, but you could submit it to some of the big auction houses.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep. I have some Steigl material, too. What I ought to do is, why don't you give me your number, and someday I will call you back when it gets nice out.
And do that. Okay, well, I tell you what, all you need to do, Tom, is you can go online to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. It's and you've got a link right there to Shirley's websites, and you can go there. Or there may be some other ones in your area that you could go to as well. But just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can get that information that you need. And thanks a lot for calling. Very much appreciate your call. Visiting today with Shirley Bauman. Shirley is a certified personal property appraiser. She's a registered Wisconsin auctioneer, and she's the owner of Bauman Auction Services and Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. So it's great to have her along. We have that information about her on our Facebook page. And Judith just told me we went over 7,000 likes on the Facebook page just a few minutes ago, so that's kind of cool, too. Shirley's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back with her. So stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If someone told you that you could appear on the Antique Roadshow, would you take it? Have you often wondered about whether something you have is worth a lot of money? Well, Larry Mueller here, Shirley Bauman with us today. She can maybe help you out. She's a certified personal property appraiser, registered Wisconsin auctioneer. Shirley, thanks again for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
We have many people with questions for you, and I want to, Jack from Milwaukee has been waiting a long time. So let's go to Jack. Thank you for waiting. Hi, what can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually in the lottery to go to the Antiques Roadshow down in Chicago in July, so that's very exciting.
Cool. Oh,
congratulations.
Thank you. My grandfather was a professor and traveled extensively throughout the world during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and he would often go to markets in various third world countries and purchase interesting things that he would find, and so we have many things back here at my family's home, but one of my most interesting pieces has been it appears to be made out of wood. I forget what the term is, but it's sort of solidified wood. And it's a nun, and it's about 10 inches tall. And if I believe right, he bought it in Somalia, perhaps. And it is still has some of the original paint on it, from what I understand. And my mother had it appraised, I think, in the 90s. And the person that she had it appraised by said that it was way too old for him to have any idea what it would be worth. He threw out the term 11th century when he thought, what he thought it would be from. I have no idea if that's true, but we have not been able to find anybody who kind of specializes in very old items. Does she have anybody locally that might be able to help us out?
Well, I don't have anybody locally, but the person that I consult with when I have something that might be of that period is one of the Antique Roadshow appraisers. His name is John Buxton. He's out of Dallas, Texas. And John does tribal arts. That's his specialty. And if you look him up on the internet, he has a gallery down there, and he's been doing the Antiques Roadshow since the beginning. John has also done a lot of teaching and appraising at the Beloit College.
Oh.
At the museum they have there. And so he does come up this way once in a while. At least he did. I haven't talked to him about that real recently. But he may be, he has gone to, I think, every road show there has been. And so he most likely will be there if you get to Chicago. But you may also contact him. And, you can say, tell him my name if you wish and that you had spoken to me and see what he might have, or contact the Anthropology Museum at Beloit College and see if they have anyone that they might recommend, maybe out of the Chicago area. They'd be more likely to know those kinds of specialists.
There you go.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jack, and good luck with that. We have Susan in Minocqua next. Hi, Susan.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's got to be 30 years ago, my husband and I bought a chair at an auction down in Oklahoma. And on the seat of the chair, it has a stamp, and it looks kind of like a kite and a circle on top. And in the top circle, there's the Roman numeral 2. And then in the middle of the kite, there's a large R and a little D with two lines under it. And then the number 24 is on the top. And on the left of the kite is a 3. Bottom is a G. And on the right is an E. And a long time ago, I saw in a book that this was an English stamp for a piece of furniture.
Well, you might be looking at a registry mark, an English registry mark.
Right.
That's
right.
In the shape of a kite, basically. And look up English registry marks.
Okay.
It might tell you when it was made, and those letters and digits all represent something. But look that up on the internet. That's quite common to see, and they have charts of what those letters and numbers mean. I can't tell you exactly without looking all that up myself, but you'll be able to find English registry marks.
And then I did have another question related to this. One of the spokes on the back of the chair, it's like a bowl, and it's broken. Now, if that's repaired, does that harm the value of the chair?
That's a hard question to answer. What I would do is start looking first at that registry mark, see if it's really an old chair. If you need to get some help to determine if it's actually a valuable chair, you can also look up construction that would help you to determine if it's very old in a particular style or something. I wouldn't do anything with it before you know what it is.
Yeah, sure.
Determine that first before you start going about getting repairs. Because if it's something valuable by a known maker, very old, you might need to get or want to get a real professional antique restoration than just a standard woodworking repair.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Luba in Madison a chance to join in. Luba, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, thank you. I have a beer mug, and it's a monkey. And it has, I think it's a pewter handle, and the cap is the monkey's head. And he's sporting a crushed, slightly crushed top hat and smoking a Sherlock Holmes pipe.
Ah. Yeah, it sounds adorable.
Yeah.
It is. And I got it in Paris in the early 1960s, and I don't know anything about it. And I have seen a few beer mugs at various places, and I've never seen anything like this.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, you have a stein and not a mug. When it's covered, it's a stein. When it's open, it's a mug. And have you looked underneath the bottom? Is there a mark on the bottom?
I can't remember any, but I may be wrong.
Okay.
But I don't think I saw any.
Well, that's the first place to look and see if there is a mark, and then you can look, search on that mark and what that means. As far as telling you right off the top, it sounds great. I would think there's certainly a following for those kind of character mugs. I'd have to do some research to try and find out who made it, when, to give you any more information than that. But I think you do have something that is worth looking into.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a book or something that I could check?
Well, if you can find the maker by a mark on the bottom, you could just start doing that. But otherwise, start searching under, beer steins, character beer steins.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
would be a topic, and you might find some books and resources that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Mark in Fond du Lac. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What have you got for us?
Absolutely. I have something that's kind of unique. I came across a cast from Gale Sayers, the football player, and it's from his thigh to his ankle. It's split in half, and it's in a display box. I believe it's from 1969 was the injury against San Francisco, and it has Brian Piccolo signed it twice. There's about 70 autographs on it.
Oh,
and
wow.
And kind of hauled around, and it's a very unique, and everybody I seem to talk to doesn't want to give me a price. They want to buy it.
Yeah. How did you happen on this?
Yeah. It was a friend of mine who picked it up. It was apparently a donation for a fundraiser.
Oh, okay.
We see a lot of unique things like this come up at fundraisers because, you know, that people are hoping that they'll get a nice price for them and get a lot for the charity that they're buying for. The thing with this is it needs to be authenticated. We need to be sure it's not just a cast that somebody had and kind of got people to sign it. So the signatures and that need to be authenticated. And so you probably want to be looking at an autograph expert for that authentication. And then once you have it authenticated, you know, as an appraiser, I don't authenticate all these things because I can't possibly be an expert on them all. But what I do is give a value on its readily apparent, what it is. And
everything is authenticated, and mm-hmm. There's only one of them in the world that could be like this because it's a cast of his legs. So,
right.
Yeah.
You know, if it is authenticated and there's, you know, like I said, Brian Piccolo had signed it twice and everything is legit, any idea price-wise where they're at?
I can't tell you price-wise right now because it's such a one-of-a-kind. It would take me a lot of research. And I'm a good friend with the woman on the Antiques Roadshow that does all the sports appraisals, and she used to be a VP up at Sotheby's, and she's done a lot of sports auctions. So that'd be the person I go to. Her name is Leela Dunbar, and check in with her.
Mm.
I contact one guy from the Antiques Roadshow. Was it Gutierrez, maybe?
Yeah.
Yep.
He's at a Heritage Auctions.
Yep, and they were kind of all over. They started originally at $1,500, and about 10 minutes into my conversation, they were over $10,000. But everything, you know, was more, you know, we can sell it for you commission-based. We can sell it for you commission-based. Nobody wanted to actually give somewhat of a concrete number.
Right. And that's because it's such a one-of-a-kind thing. Just like you said, nobody else has that. They've never sold Gil Zare's cast with all these signatures on. So they're estimating that based on some other unusual kinds of sports memorabilia with signatures. And that's probably as close as you're going to get right now. I will say that Heritage Auction has a big following on sports. Their thing is American heritage, and, you know, football and sports is part of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I've talked to Lee and we've gone through things, she's also said, let's contact Mike Gutierrez as well. So she's, also really got faith in his ability. And I think Heritage is a good auction house for something like that if that's what you want to do is sell it. So they're probably giving you as good information as you can get anywhere.
There you go. Good luck, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. We have some emails. I want to get Linda in Winona, Minnesota, inherited a beautiful diamond ring several years ago. The total of all diamonds on the ring is 1.73 carats. It's in a tutu style. She'd like to sell it. Local jewelry store, not interested. Got no interest on eBay. It was appraised in 1994 for $6,000. What would you suggest?
Well, that is another interesting question because there's first we need to know if it was appraised for insurance value at $6,000 or fair market value. If it was appraised for insurance, that's how much it would be insured for, but that's not how much you should expect to get for it. That might be really realistically a lot less. The reason you probably didn't get interest on eBay is that people are kind of shy if it's real or not. So yeah. I would get that appraisal updated, get a fair market value appraisal, and that might help you. Sometimes when we have valuable antiques, if it really has appreciated in that time period, I've gone to some of the Chicago auction houses to see what kind of estimate they might get if they want to include it in one of their fine auctions. But that's what I would suggest. Start with getting that appraisal updated because that's quite a long time ago.
And turning to Peter in Stoughton. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I have some books. Well, I'll talk about the strange one first. It's Illuminated Poems by Allen Ginsberg and Eric Drucker. It's one. It's copy 38 of 300 copies that were made, and which makes research on the internet difficult. And it's signed by both Allen Ginsberg and Eric Drucker. It's in great condition. It's in a jacket, and I'm not expecting you to be able to come up with a value for it, but. How would I go about finding a value for something as rare as this?
I think what you want to do is find an appraiser who specializes in historic papers. Mm-hmm. And I know there are some in my appraisal organization, and you can look on the International Society of Appraisers website and to find an appraiser. And contact one of those that does specialize in historic papers, autographs, that kind of thing, and or books as well. And there are some of those. And you may do some internet discussions back and forth for a while. And if they feel it's appropriate, they might do something like have someone like me or another appraiser they know help out by coming and taking a look at it for them. Instead of actually sending the book so that I could, help them in their situation in terms of do I believe it's authentic and that kind of thing and take some photographs and measurements and those sorts of things for them. We've done that before on Real Specialized Rare Things. The other thing you could do, as we talked about with another caller, is, take all the information you can in photographs and contact a major auction house and ask them if there's something they're interested in. And look at someone that has book and manuscript auctions. And I know the big auction houses do.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Peter. Thank you. Elizabeth in Fox Point, hi to you.
Hi. I had a question about the cost of appraisals. I was trying to have something appraised, and I talked to a couple of different appraisers, and the cost varied from $200 to do the appraisal to $1,200 to do the appraisal. So how do you have some idea of what an appraisal should actually cost?
And what were you trying to have appraised?
It's a grandfather clock.
Okay. I can tell you what I do and the people in my association normally do, my professional association, is that we charge by the hour. And my particular fee, I'll just tell you, is $165 an hour. Some people charge more. Some people charge less. Some people do charge a flat fee. And I guess that's what they were doing. I don't like to do that. I'd rather, give you the value of the time I put into it, and that would include inspecting the item, taking photographs, taking measurements, looking over the item, then going and doing my appropriate research on the valuation and what they're going for now and the maker and all that kind of thing, and then putting together a report for you, writing up all the information that I found out and giving you a valuation in that and my analysis of why it's worth that amount. So,
well, I think both were basing it on an hourly rate. It just appeared that they thought it would take drastically different amount of time to appraise.
Yeah.
And the name of the maker of the clock is on the face of the clock, but even something as basic as when the clock was made, I've heard anything from 17th century to it was something I inherited, and I believe in the inheritance they said it was 19th century. So I don't know if the person who did the estate appraisal had any, how much effort they put into appraising it either.
Yeah, yeah.
but I just thought it was pretty different, the estimates that I got.
Yeah, and, you know, their hourly rate may have been very different, too, because maybe one was very experienced, had a lot of credentials, and one was maybe lesser experienced and just, you know,
well,
charged.
They both seem to be reputable, and the one that said it would be about $200 actually works for the museum. And so I was given his name because he was going to be in town to do work for the museum.
Okay. All right.
So I just found it very difficult to understand. And since, you know, my interest was in knowing whether or not it was having the item restored or how much money I should put into the item, you know, if the appraisal is going to cost you more than the item is potentially worth.
Right. I usually do tell people that if I can ahead of time, if they bring me something, I don't know, a bowl or something, and I will tell them that it probably isn't worth the investment in an appraisal because the time would, would outweigh the value of the item. I can't tell you exactly what was going on in those people's minds, and maybe the one person just gave you a high estimate to make sure they covered themselves. I really can't speak to that.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Laura emailed us and said her great aunt had a Tiffany dragonfly lamp since the 30s. It's lovely. The base has Tiffany stamped on it, but we've never been able to find similar stamp on the shade. Were there fake Tiffany's that long ago? Or can we feel relatively confident it is what we've always thought?
That's kind of a hard question to answer. You've certainly got the stamp on the base. The other thing is sometimes they use some paper labels, which could have gotten separated. I would look real clearly under very high, good, intense light on that inside rim of the lampshade to see if you can see it. And look at pictures of that dragonfly lamp to see if it's exact or not, measurements and all of that. Now, I don't know if there were people that actually tried to fake it, but there were a lot of glass makers that made those style of shades during that period. So they may have actually made a dragonfly that looked similar, not really intending to be a fraud, but that was a motif that was, selling well and popular at the time. So it could have been another maker. So you want to look real carefully, and the quality of the glass and the workmanship on a Tiffany. If you start looking at them, actually, I believe there's a Tiffany example in the Oshkosh Museum right now or coming up. And so maybe you can go ahead and look at some of them at the museum. And once you see those Tiffany's, and sometimes you can compare them to another and you can say, no, this just isn't that quality because Tiffany was really that high end. So those
might have been
a
Tiffany
things.
Base, and maybe the lamp got broken.
Exactly. The shade is what often gets broken. And they may have found a dragonfly that looks similar.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say.
Well, Shirley, it's always a pleasure. We had so many calls, and we had lots of online questions that unfortunately we didn't get to.
Yeah.
But you'll come back and be with us again?
Oh, I'd love to.
We'd certainly love to have you back. Shirley Bauman, certified personal property appraiser. She's a registered Wisconsin auctioneer, owns Bauman Auction Services and Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services. And we do have some links to her websites on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. So you can take a look at that and link right into her. Tomorrow, we're talking about worm composting, talk about how to do it at 11. And then we'll take a look at some bioenergy issues at 11:45. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.